This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed by watching some of their work or, in some cases, listening to some of their work that we weren't previously familiar with. My name is Matt Brown.
And I'm Matthew Price. And
how are you, Mr. Price?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Oh, I'm all right.
I'm pretty good.
Good. Good.
I did some listening this month, which was really interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be a slightly,
different.
There is no right way to do this show, and God knows, based on at least half the episodes thus far, there's some wrong ways. But yeah.
As soon as you said it, I was like, well, clearly, just listen to all the ways we're doing it.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah,
there is no right way for us to do it.
But today we are going to be looking at the life and career of an icon of American music who had very little to do with the movies, except that her songs were basically in all of them. Actually, right after she died, I did a list on Letterboxd of movies that included some of her work, and I had to sort of stop including the ones that used respect, because there's like 40 of them.
It's
a lot. Anyway, obviously, we will talk about Aretha Franklin,
yes,
who died on August 16th of this year at the age of 76. So yeah, we will get into all that. I did watch a film that I had not seen before. You listened to some music. Which, had you heard the music before?
Probably. I had heard some of it, but what I did was rather than listening to singles, and which I think is how most people experience music these days, is just sort of like especially for an older artist, as greatest hits. I bought whole albums and listened to them, as an exercise, like listen to the whole album to try to get a better sense of what it would have been like. The project for me was, well, what would it have been like to listen to these albums when they were coming out?
That's awesome.
I can't really know, but I tried my best to recreate.
Fantastic. Yeah. So before we get into that, it's time to do a little something we call roll call.
Roll call. Am I diving right into roll call? Wow.
Roll call comes up faster than you ever seem to expect.
I'm
roll
never ready.
Roll call is right off the top.
Roll call.
Okay, here comes roll call. Yeah. So this, of course, is our monthly segment just talking about trying to note everyone else who has passed since we last recorded a show.
Yep.
To try to keep track of all of this. Because,
that's right.
You know, we do 12 of these a year. Surprisingly, more than 12 people die every year.
Yeah.
I did not know that until I started doing the show.
The weight is incredible.
It's somewhere north of double that amount.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
So, yeah. So I keep track through the month, and here we go. So we'll start with Robert Wood, who was a United Church minister, and the reason he is significant is he's the first man of the cloth to argue for acceptance of LGBTQ parishioners.
Right on, Robert Wood.
Yeah. So that was, a very significant figure in the early fight for rights, and I thought, okay. And then it was I think it's the second or third month in a row, not a great month if you're a storied artist in the comics industry. We lost Marie Severin, who was, among many other things, the creator of Spider-Woman.
Right.
But also was, from what I can tell, one of these Swiss Army knife artists that they could just pitch into anything and she would do it. And did it at a time when, there were no other women doing it. So, like everything you've seen on Mad Men, triple that up because it's comics. And that's what she had to kind of go through.
Right? Yeah.
And then we also lost Russ Heath, who did tons of comics as well, including Marvel Tales, lots of others. But here's what I find interesting is he is the artist whose particular graphic style was the primary inspiration for Roy Lichtenstein, for those Lichtenstein paintings of comics that came out of the pop art movement. That's
gotcha.
Russ Heath.
Gotcha.
I'm going to eulogize a little bit. We lost the Village Voice.
We sure did.
Yeah.
Holy God. Yeah.
Significant demise.
Yeah. That was, not a gargantuan surprise, because there's certainly been indications for the last couple of years that the new owner was going to fuck with them hard. But yeah.
Here's where we are in media.
Yep.
If there isn't some angel investor who just wants to look after you, you're dead.
Yeah.
You're dead.
Yep.
Lost the Village Voice. Vanessa Marquez. Was Nurse Goldman on ER, which I think probably means more to you than to me. I was not that big.
I mean,
ER
she
fan,
was an enormous character, but definitely Wendy was a memorable character and actually the subject of one of my all-time favorite ER lines that I still just say under my breath when things are going on, which is that Dr. Weaver says, "Everyone is so on their toes today," and then Wendy like trips on something or something and she goes, "Except for Wendy." And I just I still say that all the time. Anyway, I mean it is a very sad story and
it's horrendous. She died confronting police, right? And they were shot.
Exactly.
And so we don't know if I think there was some Is it mental illness? That was
there was certainly there was indications that there was mental illness in the last 10 or 15 years.
So, so we lost her. We lost some other notable actresses as well. Carol Shelley was a wonderful British actress, did voices in Disney's Robin Hood and in Hercules, is best known for being one of the two beautiful British sisters in The Odd Couple. Who they try to date, the Pigeon Sisters. Great.
All right.
Great name. And many other things on stage and everything else. We lost her. We lost Susan Brown, who's very well known for General Hospital and one of these soap actresses that did, you know, like 100 years of shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then not a great year for, or not a great month for New York City food institutions, which I think means something to me because I like going there and I've been to these places. But Kenny Shopson, who is a owned this restaurant called Shopson's, which has a menu of something like 500 items, and is.
Did he die from the stress?
No, but it was one of the. But apparently, he designed the menu with the idea that it would keep tourists away because they would look at the menu and be like, "Well, that just seems crazy.
This is unparsable. I can't go into this."
Yeah, and so they made like they had like it's one of these places that has a million pieces of bric-a-brac and memorabilia inside it and stuff. Anyway, it's, so there's that, and then just like this week. And Russ Fetterman, who is the last daughter from Russ and Daughters, which is the sort of original New York City Jewish dairy store. So smoked fish, cream cheeses, bagels, that kind of stuff, which is like it's called an appetizing store. And Russ and Daughters is right on the street right beside Katz's Deli and is sort of like the ground zero of Jewish food culture in New York City, and she's the last surviving sort of original family member of that, that clan. So, we lost Jacqueline Pierce, who was an actress who appeared in Doctor Who.
Playing who?
I wish I'd written it down.
Yeah, no, I don't know. There's a lot of, you know what? There's a lot of it. It's hard.
Yeah. Jeb J. Rosebrook.
All right.
Who wrote... I guess he was a screenwriter. He wrote for the Waltons, but here's what I thought was so cool. He wrote Junior Bonner, which is the rodeo movie that is a great movie, rodeo movie that Steve McQueen was in.
All right.
And he wrote The Black Hole.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I thought it was kind of cool. Yeah. So anyway, we lost him. Christopher Lawford, who was an actor, he was the son of Peter Lawford. So that, of course, made him JFK's nephew.
Oh.
And if you'd seen him, you'd be like, oh yeah, that looks exactly like Peter Lawford. Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
That might be the biggest this year.
He's a pretty big deal.
That's a pretty big one. I'm not sure. I mean, lots got said that put it in context, but in case you sort of are not aware of how big a star Burt Reynolds was, Smokey and the Bandit made like was a bigger hit or he was a bigger movie star than anybody when Star Wars was out. Like he was still a bigger deal.
Yeah.
You know, and for basically enjoying himself, which is kind of amazing. Right?
Yeah. He's got, I mean, they were saying this on See You Next Wednesday as well. He's just, I mean, what a weird career.
Because it's a great career.
It's
though.
A great. It's like there's a, nothing yeah, wrong yeah, with it. This yeah. isn't a value judgment. Yeah. It's just like he could be in such great stuff back-to-back with such flyweight,
with
seemingly inconsequential schlock.
But all through, the thing is, he's having a good time.
Yeah.
You know? And that's,
but like,
you know.
And then he does Evening Shade, and then he does Boogie Nights, but he hates Boogie Nights. Like, he's just such a weird guy, you know? Like, it's such a fascinating career. My sister has a thing for two older actors who basically worked for the most part before she even grew up. One is Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
The other is Michael Douglas. So when Burt Reynolds died, she named her cat after Burt Reynolds. Her cat's name is Burt.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
Yeah, so I mean,
he was unbelievably handsome.
When he died, I was like, I texted her. I'm like, you need to sit down. And then I told her.
Oh, wow.
It was one of those.
Mac Miller, who's a hip hop artist and died of a drug overdose, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful 70s character actor Bill Daly actually started out as sort of the second banana on I Dream of Jeannie and is one of the many amazing actors who would rotate out of the Bob Newhart show as one of his patients. Bill, which is like, if you just saw that list of faces, like just a picture of all those faces, you'd be like, that is impressive. Look at those faces. Like, they're all, you know, anyway. we lost Bill Daly. Also, and again, a really interesting one, Will Jordan, who I'd never heard of, who was an impressionist. He was the first impressionist to do an impression of Ed Sullivan. He did it on the Ed Sullivan show.
Really?
His impression of Ed Sullivan is so good that essentially other impressionists are doing his impression. They're not doing Ed Sullivan.
Right.
They're doing him.
Yep.
Diane Leather, who was the first woman to break the 5-minute mile.
Mm-hmm.
Andre Blay. You know who Andre Blay was?
No. Who's Andre Blay?
The inventor of home entertainment.
Say again.
He is the founder of a company called Magnetic Video, and he is the person who convinced Fox to let him make videotapes.
Cool.
Yes. He was the one who basically went to this one studio and said, I think if we make these videotapes, people might buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So he is the inventor of home entertainment.
Fantastic.
Which I think is pretty amazing.
Well done, buddy.
Yeah. Walter Mischel is a psychologist, best known for inventing the marshmallow test. Do you know what the marshmallow test is?
No, I do not.
Put a child in a room with a marshmallow. And you say, okay, if you would like, you can eat this marshmallow. I'm going to go out of the room for a couple minutes. But if you wait, when I come back, you can have 2 marshmallows. And then you wait and see whether he'll eat the marshmallow or not.
And what does it prove if he does?
It's supposed to prove whether someone has impulse control or not.
I see.
And it's supposed to, was for a long time considered to be a predictor of whether you would be a successful adult. So if you were a child that waited, then you were considered to have a better chance of being a successful adult. It has since been, you know, disproven as perhaps not as good an indicator as people thought. But it is an interesting experiment nonetheless.
Absolutely.
Peter Donat, Canadian actor. William
played Mulder's dad on
William
the X-Files.
William Mulder in the X-Files.
Yep.
And, interestingly enough, was very nearly cast as Tom Hagen in The Godfather.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's wild.
It is. Big J McNeely, who is an R&B sax player. Legend in the R&B world, great sax player. Thad Mumford was a writer, black writer who came of age in the 1970s, started working then, and started on Electric Company, wrote for Sesame Street, but wrote for quote-unquote black shows and white shows. Wrote for MASH, wrote for Maude, but also wrote for Good Times and that stuff.
Gotcha.
Eventually became the executive producer of A Different World for Cosby, and that's where I recognized the name from. And, you know, and I think interesting that you could, you know, that he was able to create a career that was not race blind, but that where he was able to move into circles that didn't necessarily line up with his background, right?
Right.
Alan Abel, who is a, and I love this when this happens, by profession, he was a professional hoaxer. His life was dedicated to creating media hoaxes and fooling people. And he actually already died, in quotes, in 1980, which that is the best. So he had already had an obituary in the New York Times.
Nice.
Because he fooled them into thinking he was dead. My favorite thing is that he, in like 1960, he created this Society for Indecency to Naked Animals, or Sina, whose purpose in life was to make sure that animals all wore clothes because they were naked.
Yep.
And He didn't admit the hoax for more than 3 years.
Nice.
People published articles about... He got people to join before he revealed that the thing was made up.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
I can see why this person appeals to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, wrote, like, this is old school stuff. So, like, making up fake letterhead, having new phone numbers for things, having people answer, pretend to be other people. Like, this pre-internet idea of fooling the media is so, to me, I find it tantalizing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then just very recently, the last two on my list. So, Al Matthews. An actor. He, you may remember him because he was the drill sergeant character in Aliens.
Oh,
black
shit.
Black actor.
That guy died?
Yeah. You want him? Get him. You know, no. Yeah.
Assholes and elbows. Hudson, come here.
Yeah, exactly.
Come here.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah,
oh, fuck, man. I love that guy.
Yeah. And then just today, Gary Kurtz.
Yeah.
The producer of Star Wars.
The producer of Star Wars.
American Graffiti.
Yep. Tulane Blacktop.
Yep.
Dark Crystal, Return to Oz, and then he basically dropped the mic for like 20 years.
Didn't need to. Well,
I'm sure he would have wanted to work. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, it's funny. He has, according to IMDb, he has 22 credits, six of which are upcoming. So
interesting.
He had projects,
so he had,
I guess, but, you know, or
That's
had lent his name to things. Yeah.
He's also one of the only people in the history of the human race who could make the mustacheless beard or the Shenandoah look good. You know, all those production photos from Star Wars people were sharing around today. I'm like, God damn, look at you.
He has the Amish thing
going? He has the Amish thing.
Oh, wow.
Going. Yeah, it's really, it's hard. That's
wow.
hard. That is hard to do well.
I know.
Yeah. I've been thinking about taking my mustache off just for the next few days. A little tribute. But then I'm getting on a plane on Saturday, and I'm pretty sure that
I don't want to be in with other people with that.
Trouble that I don't need. All right.
All right. Let's talk about Aretha Franklin.
Let's do some quick bio on Aretha Franklin. I mean, I think most of it may come out in the discussion of the work. But
I believe she was black.
That's correct.
Okay, good.
Yeah, she was born on March 25th,
1942,
Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
The family then relocated to Detroit for most of her young life. The marriage broke up due to infidelities. You know, you can hear it all in the music. her mother died of a heart attack just before Aretha turned 10. I mean, the first few paragraphs of her Wikipedia entry, they're not fun. There's a lot of bad shit going on in there. So her dad was a renowned preacher. He was known for, and I quote, the million-dollar voice that he brought to his preaching. His congregation included such luminaries as Martin Luther King, Jackie Wilson, Clara Ward, who began to mentor Aretha on singing. She began singing age 12 with her dad as her manager because, again, that's how these stories always seem to go. Her first record was released in 1956. So she would have been 14.
Yes.
That's mental. She goes on tour
with
Martin Luther.
Well, it's her dad making her make a record.
Absolutely.
Like, it's definitely not really her yet.
She's touring with Martin Luther King Jr. when she's 16.
Sure.
You know, she is
singing gospel.
Absolutely. Singing gospel.
Yeah. And that's what I'm talking about is she's that early part of her career is like, go sing gospel and drum up business for my church.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? So she's just singing spirituals and so on and so forth. But she gets to her first secular album when she's 19 years old. That's released by Columbia in 1961. She eventually moves over to Atlantic in 67, which is where I think the career really peaks. Like all the ones
100%.
That you know off the top of your head, Natural Woman, Respect, it's all
very,
in there. And then obviously goes on to have this huge and influential career in music for the next 30, 40 years of her life. Dies of pancreatic cancer in August of this year. So that's Aretha Franklin in a nutshell. Now, you listened to records.
Did I ever?
I watched a movie.
Yeah.
Who's going first?
This is, I don't know. Is the part about the movie going to be a bummer?
I mean, I don't think it's going to be a bummer.
Okay. Let's talk about the movie.
Let's lay it out, guys. Sometimes there are movies that are considered fundamental to the human experience that for one reason or another, you just had not
seen. You haven't seen.
You haven't got around to.
And here's what I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Given how whatever, it's fundamental. I just love that movie.
Fundamental to the human
experience. How did you mentally prepare? Did you mentally prepare to try to go in as open to that movie as you could in a way that you don't normally, or is it the same?
No, that's not how I play this game.
I understand. I'm just curious.
No, I don't do that. I, you know, like one of the reasons that I like this show is it's an opportunity to, you know, circle around on some of the movies. Like, and I also watched The Big Chill this weekend because I'd also never seen that.
Oh, well, let's talk about that too.
Well, there's not,
okay,
really,
right.
You know, I mean, that's one song. That's what I'm talking about when I made the list
of
movies that, and, you know, it's a great moment, but it is one song.
Yeah, fair.
But yeah, I'd never watched The Blues Brothers. 1980, John Landis film, The Blues Brothers. And, you know, I was aware of The Blues Brothers. Like, I knew who they were. They come out on Saturday Night Live every now and again. You know, I mean, like,
Were you aware of this movie in the way that sometimes people are aware of, like, say, Casablanca, where you knew you had already been tipped to many of the bits? No, I just meant...
No.
Like, do you know what I mean? When you first watch Casablanca, you're like, yeah, it's all those bits that you've already told me.
No. So the interesting thing about this is, like, literally the only bit from Blues Brothers that I basically have memorized is Steven Spielberg's cameo, because they played it in the AFI's tribute to Steven Spielberg in, like, 1995.
Okay.
So I'd seen that a few times because I had that on tape. I watched it a few times. But other than that, I really didn't know anything about the structure or plot of the Blues Brothers.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it came in pretty clean. I'm not an enormous fan of famed killer of Vietnamese children, John Landis. But I was like, you know what? I had a pretty good time with American Werewolf. I'm going to enjoy this. So I go and I watch it. Here's what I did not know going in, and as soon as I pressed play, I was so fucking glad that I was not watching this with other people. Goddamn movie is 2.5 hours long.
Two and a half hours. Yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot in there.
That is too long.
No, it's not.
No, that's too long for me. I have two extremely inviolate rules when it comes to comedies.
Okay.
One. 90 minutes. Two, got to be funny. Now, I'm not saying The Blues Brothers is not funny, but there is a gap at the heart of this thing for me, which is
there's an enormous slowdown at one point.
No, for sure. No, there's a gap at the heart of this concept for me, which is that I have never in my life, and I always thought it was because I hadn't seen the movie, I have never in my life found The Blues Brothers funny.
Okay.
Like, as a concept, as an act, as a character pair, I never found them funny. And to my chagrin, they ain't funny in this movie either. There's a lot of funny shit in this movie. A lot of things in this movie where I was, like, screaming out loud laughing. It was almost never them. Carrie Fisher shows up with a machine
doesn't
gun and a bazooka and a bomb.
Doesn't just show up.
I mean, it's,
she steals this movie out from under
them. She literally
steals the movie out from under them.
I think the concept of stealing a movie might well have been invented for Carrie Fisher in this film.
However, I am surprised because I do find the chemistry and the relationship and the idea of these dudes to be very funny.
Yeah, see, I just don't. I don't get it. And I mean, I know it's impossible to explain comedy.
Of course,
to somebody,
I'm not going to try.
I just don't get it. Don't get it. There's nothing there, you know? And I found it really. I mean, again, like, look, the movie is very entertaining because whenever nothing goes on for long enough, they either burst into an incredible musical number or have an incredible car chase. So you can't get very far in this movie without something entertaining happening.
Well, that's just it. I mean,
I just watched It's a Mad, 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 Mad World for the first time, like, 3 or 4 months ago, and I was like, oh, it's like that. There's a bunch of kooky people, and they're chasing around trying to do something, and crazy shit just keeps happening to them all the way along as they're doing their thing. I'm like, that's fine. But that's another example of when that comedy's 2 hours and 45 minutes. And I'm just like, guys, we need to create some standards, okay? There needs to be an appreciation for how tired I am and just how daunting that 150-minute runtime is when you see it in front of you.
So I just want to say, and really on behalf of, I think, most people who have seen it, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, I know.
So that's fine. Yeah. No, and, you know, and these are all good points. I think, you know, for me and I think for the people who love that movie, that runtime is generally not a problem because that movie is, to me anyway, a kind of a juggernaut of unstoppable entertainment value where, the musical numbers are off the charts great. And bearing in mind that they are 100% designed so that white people can appreciate them. And you know what? That's okie dokie.
That was, like, the other thing I was, like, going to say. It is a little weird to come into, at, you know, in 2018 and be like, look at these two white people taking me on a tour of black
music.
And that's what it is.
In the best spirit of it, it's saying, hello, white people, we think you missed something really important here.
Right.
So that's okay. And that's what I truly think it is. And I think, you know, I think it is definitely a white gaze on black culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good one.
Oh.
So it's okay. Like, but it is a good one. But I think apart from that, that movie cracks me the fuck up. Like, there
Look,
is
man,
so much
The thing where
detail.
The neo-Nazis go off the end of the bridge.
Oh,
and then
sure.
they drop the car from what I assume was like a couple of kilometers
yeah.
in the air. In
We've
front
had
of
fish
the,
there.
In front of the fucking Sears Tower. It's just falling
yes.
through
yes.
empty space, and yeah. then it falls past the Sears yeah. Tower. I'm like, that is extremely funny.
Yeah. Yeah, but also just like,
says, like
little
I
stuff
always
that,
loved you. I mean, that's very funny.
Yeah, but little stuff that they just thought up on the moment, like having when they're having all those SWAT guys come up and then putting on the ADR, just guys going, hut, hut, hut,
yeah,
hut,
very,
hut.
That,
right?
Another example, extremely funny.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah
you know,
I was
and
saying that all
kind
day.
Of anarchy, yeah. smart, whatever, this is like high achievement.
Yeah.
So I love the movie. What did you think of Aretha's
scene? Well, let's get
scene?
To
let's
I
get
think
to
her
that.
Scene is probably one of the best. I mean, for the musical stuff, I think actually hers is my favorite. Not just because I was watching
No, it's
because
it's the best
for
song.
This. Yeah, it's a
yeah.
really, it's yeah. It's a beautiful rendition of the song. It's incredible choreography, which is another, I mean, I'm not trying to like damn with faint praise here. I did feel there were several musical numbers where Landis didn't quite have the visual chops to match what I imagined was going on with the performances. But in that scene, it works. Like,
yeah.
it's a nicely staged sequence.
Yeah,
the
Ray Charles scene
great.
Is really good, but that scene is tremendous.
Yeah, that's just an awesome scene. And she's not the best actor.
No, but it's okay.
But she belts
because her,
the shit out of
her
that
role
scene.
Is to walk out and be Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and also, I think the other really smart thing is that it's not Respect.
Yes.
Which makes it special.
Yep,
right?
Agree.
And apparently that was something that gets discussed on the set, is that she showed up going, well, I'm going to do Respect, right? And he was like, no,
mm-hmm.
I'd like you to do this song. And she was like, oh, that's, you know, so,
right.
yeah. But yeah, that whole scene, the way it's structured, the give me four fried chickens and some toast, like, just.
And then the guy in the back knows it's
yeah, yeah,
four
yeah.
fried chickens and. And
is Elwood
toast.
Out of prison? Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. Like yeah. those, that is funny to me. Those guys. That's you know what's funny when he goes when the train goes like this far from their window. He goes, how often does that train go by? So often you hardly notice.
You hardly notice.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, admittedly, there are some funny lines between the two of them, but I always found that those two characters were kind of the delivery mechanism for everything else. Rather,
oh,
than,
they are. Yeah, absolutely.
In and
yeah,
of
they
themselves.
Are. They are the conveyance. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So. You know,
okay.
I may have had to watch it in two sittings because it is much longer than I thought it was. But, you know, that's a reasonable time watching the Blues Brothers. Let's talk about some of the records.
Absolutely. So I'm just going to – can't decide what we're going to do. Are we going to
– What are you going to do?
Well, I don't know if I want to – I'm not going to play any music. But I'm going
to – All right.
I'm going to tell you about
music.
That's
good because that saves me having to edit.
Yeah. Well, I was going to play it under talking, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to say,
do what you got to do.
These are the albums.
All right,
and I'm going to go through them. So I did listen to her last non, like her first album from 1962,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting because it's pretty. I mean, all of her albums are essentially taking other people's songs and owning the shit out of them.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, and this is an album that is interesting in the sense that here's a person who's coming from gospel, has decided that she wants to be a popular entertainer, which in 1962 means she's singing standards pretty much.
Right.
They're not particularly soul songs. There are some boppers on there. But what's really interesting is that the one song that really is a bop on this album is a song called Rough Lover, which is so against the whatever brand I thought Aretha Franklin had that the first time I listened to it, I was almost shocked. It's pretty much a song about how I want a man who will slap me up and down when I'm not good enough. And I was like, who is this?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And I'm just going to say, it's a good song, but, you know,
yeah.
it's a little hard to listen to.
Yep.
And you realize, like, what changes when she gets kind of her own voice is she's going to speak for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that's the album from 1962. It is called The Electrifying Aretha Franklin.
All right.
It does not, it has, you know, a lot of good songs on it. She sings Accentuate the Positive and You Made Me Love You and Rockabye Your Baby with a Dixie Melody. So it goes all over the American Songbook,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's not an album that I think anybody particularly knows, and I don't think anything on it would be like, ah, that's Aretha, you know.
Right.
And the very next album that I got to is I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You, which is the album that starts with Respect. It was recorded in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you get it, because it's not just, like, for me anyway, it's not just that she has this incredible voice, but that she seems so uniquely well-suited to singing subject matter that says, I'm important, what I believe is important, and I better be listened to. So Respect is, like, obviously right. the you know, the stake in the ground of that. But that's not the only, you know, Natural Woman and all these, the songs that she's the most well-known for, Chain mm-hmm. of Fools and all these songs, they are songs about being empowered. And I think, well, so first of all, I think it's impossible to divorce that from the fact that she was so instrumental in the civil rights movement
mm-hmm.
that I think these are songs she has clear conviction about.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when she sings from the point of view of a woman, she isn't a victim. And often she takes a male-centric song like Respect and turns it into a woman's point of view
mm-hmm.
and isn't the victim.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, when it comes to music, I'm an idiot, but I was startled today to learn or relearn that R.E.S.P.C.T. was actually a cover of a male-fronted song.
Yeah, which, when you think about it in the male context, is
horrifying.
Foul a
yeah,
bit. Yeah,
just
yeah.
awful.
Yeah, so she followed that up with what I think many people would argue is, and this is the other thing, is she put out an album a year or more.
Mm-hmm.
Every year. So 1968, she had two albums,
mm-hmm.
both classics. One is, I would say that most people, if you said name an Aretha Franklin album, they would name this one, Lady Soul,
mm-hmm.
Which has Chain of Fools, has People Get Ready, has Natural Woman, has Comeback Baby, Groovin'. And again, it's amazing to see her build on the success of Respect and actually go, oh, I'm going to make whole albums of this kind of stuff. Right.
Mm-hmm.
She also did what I think is my favorite record, Aretha Now, the same year. Nighttime is the Right Time, Say a Little Prayer, which, you know, there's, okay, so I didn't even have to listen to the music to know this, but, you know, there's this thing where there's certain artists, I would say she's one, Sinatra, I'm trying to think of some other, there are others, but where, if they sing your song, now it's their fucking song.
Yeah. No, those are two right? very good examples.
Right? If Frank Sinatra sang your song, it wasn't your song anymore.
Right.
If Aretha Franklin sang your song, it wasn't your song anymore. To take Say a Little Prayer from Me away from Dionne Warwick,
yep.
that's so, and she does.
Mm-hmm.
She does. And I like the Dionne Warwick version.
Sure.
But, like, you know, she took Natural Woman away from someone else. Like,
yeah.
that's, and then it's hers forever.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, so it's kind of amazing in that sense. I love Aretha Now. If you're looking for a recommendation of, like, well, what's the one album that you think I should listen to, I would say it's
Aretha
this one.
Now.
It's Aretha Now.
Mm-hmm.
And this was interesting. So, I listened to the next album, which I thought was not as good, and I was trying to figure out why. It's called Soul 69, so she did it the next year. I listened to it twice because I didn't like it. I couldn't figure it out, and I figured it out. The songs in the album aren't empowering. They're about victims.
Hmm.
And so I'm trying to – and so I don't know. I wrestled with it a bit because I thought, well, maybe she – I don't know what the reason was to – but she sings a lot of songs that I think you could fairly say. One of the songs is called Pitiful.
Hmm.
Like, they're not songs about taking. They're songs about being – doled out to on
right.
some level. So, and I don't think, you know, and I don't recognize any of these songs, so I don't think any of them were necessarily really super big hits.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't know what happened there. It's not a great album.
Okay.
At least for my way of thinking. The only thing I could think is that maybe she's trying to, you know, give a respect and give a due to people who are on the other side of that coin of empowerment
mm-hmm.
and who, you know, can't get it because they're in an oppressive situation.
Right.
But it's interesting to see her it is like a change in gears.
Yeah.
You know? And it's also called Soul 69, and almost all the songs are blues songs.
Mm-hmm.
It's really strange. Like, anyway, I kept going. The stuff that she does after that, I think, is all uniformly great. There's a great album from 1970 called Spirit in the Dark. It has my favorite album cover. I'm just going to quickly show you. Just a blue, light, and black
nice.
Kind of beautiful picture of her. She sings The Thrill Is Gone, the B.B. King song, lots of other stuff. And it's great. So I listened to that. I listened to then she finally skipped a year, and in 1972, again, two albums.
Yeah.
One is a gospel record done in front of done in a church live with what sounds like 2,000 singers. has an 11-minute long version of Amazing Grace.
Wow.
This album's called Amazing Grace.
Mm-hmm.
Her father is on it. And it's a lot of like, you can hear the pastor, you can hear people in the, you know, testify and a lot of that kind of great stuff, and totally, totally mind boggling.
Mm-hmm.
And different singing, like almost all head singing as opposed to chest singing. And,
right.
And then in the same year did another album, which pushes further into 70s funky stuff. And it's called Young, Gifted, and Black.
Nice.
I was like, I might be in love. So, and that, if you are looking for kind of like a more progressive kind of sound, that's the album where it goes heavily towards sort of, the other thing that happens with these albums, of course, is that the production gets more and more and more sort of geared towards her and interesting. And, you know, it's so, I think one of the reasons that we're, you know, beyond just having the baby boom, but that period of sort of the mid-60s to the early 70s is this sort of period that doesn't seem to want to go away.
Mm-hmm.
It's because not just are these artists developing, but the technology that records music is developing.
Right.
Like
yeah.
you start the 1960s with, you know, barely stereo, and you end 1975 with 24-track,
right.
You know, and every reverb, any effect you want on music and whatever. And that's a huge, I mean, that's arguably a bigger jump than sort of talkies. Movies, right? So, you know, I think that's part of what's so interesting about hearing these full albums in a row, where they, you know, year by year, they just get better at producing, and she gets better at orchestrating and figuring out how to, you know, how to make these sounds feature her better. So, yeah.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
Right on.
And then what happened? That The other thing I think about this show a lot is, you know, we get to do this at the end, so it's like, let's take a person in totality, and it's all good. But, you know, that woman struggled for, like, a lot of years and did not have a lot of output. And I'd love to know kind of, like, on just an artistic level, where she stopped necessarily connecting with audiences or why it became more difficult for her. I always feel like, you know, she never got her – so one of the reasons I listen to albums is because there's no real concert film for her.
Right.
So she never got her like Elvis comeback special. There's no
right.
There's no concert in Central Park for Aretha Franklin. There's no definitive moment late in the career that goes like, you all forgot, but I'm amazing, and that's important. And if you don't get that, I think you lose something, right?
Yeah.
Do you know the story about Nessun Dorma? This is my favorite
story. No, go for it.
So I was also reading her Wikipedia page.
Yep.
Apparently she so. I don't know if this was the Grammys. I think it was a Grammys, but it might have been something else. But anyway, she was booked on the show, and Pavarotti was booked on the show to sing Nessun Dorma. And during the show, called and said, I'm too sick. I cannot get to the show.
Nice.
I can't sing Nessun Dorma. And she said, well, I can sing Nessun Dorma.
Wow.
And stepped in, sang this unbelievable aria, and then like that version of the song went on to sell like a million copies. Like,
nice.
Yeah, like who goes, oh yeah, I got that in my, yeah, that's one of the paintbrushes in my paint box.
Yeah,
I could just, sure, I can whip out classical opera too.
Sure.
You know, that's amazing.
But artists like that, I mean, you look at the upbringing, you look at the sort of the range of music that she
also
grew up
can't
with.
Read music.
I know, that's crazy.
Yeah,
that's really, that makes it all significantly more impressive.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that. That's one of the things I like about that era of performers is the thing that they could have something weird and random in their toolbox like that and be like, yeah, I used to do that in the shower. Like, whatever.
Yeah,
you know, like,
I know.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's all very interesting. All right. Well, thank you all very much for listening. And if you have any anything you'd like to call out that we might have missed, you can get at us on Twitter at DeathWatchPod. You can get on us on Letterboxd, also at DeathWatchPod. Or you can leave comments at ModernSuperior.com, which is where we're hosted. We are going to be back at the end of October. Have not quite determined who will be the candidate for October. I mean, Burt Reynolds is a good one because that's obviously a huge career. I've never seen Deliverance. So,
oh, here we go.
There's room to be done there.
Here we go.
But yeah, we'll make
and
a decision.
And I will be watching Stick. No, I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
Do the Burt Reynolds episode of The Golden Girls.
But that'd be fun.
It's very funny. Well, it's The Golden Girls. They were all funny.
Yeah.
Top to bottom. But yeah, anyway, thank you all very much for listening, and we will be at you again next month.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.